Hello and welcome to the 18th episode of Only Foreign Films. I'm Patrick.
And I'm Amanda, and we are joined by our lovely guest, Jake Garcia.
Hello, guys.
Hi.
Hi.
How are you doing?
I'm doing well. How are you?
I'm good. Well, thank you so much for joining us on the podcast.
I know, it's about time.
I know, it's been a minute.
Yeah.
I've wanted to get you on here for a while, and I'm glad we're finally going to do it. It'll be the, not the first episode of the year, but... Because we released the first episode.
Oh, today's the 6th?
Yeah, this would be the first
one. Well, the first one recorded in the new year. But we released the other episode in the new year, right?
Or was
it the 31st? Maybe on the 31st.
Yeah.
Then this is a first episode of the new year, recorded and released.
Yeah, because we made a huge deal about that being the last episode of the decade. Mm-hmm. So, this ought to be.
Awesome.
I'm excited.
Me too.
I'm excited. You're more of a listener than a talker, usually, based on your desired profession.
That's true. Yeah, I'm. Am I the first? No, because Carter's been on.
And Joe.
And Joe? No.
Yeah. It's an audio podcast, so we like our sound peeps.
Yeah, I like sound. Sound is my bag. It's what I do.
If you want to talk a little bit more about yourself.
My name's Jake. I just graduated from Towson, so that's cool. I have a degree in audio.
How's it feel to say that?
I don't have it in my hand yet, which is really...
Oh, yeah, it doesn't get sent takes a while.
It's like February or March, I'll probably be getting it.
Oh, shit.
But it's cool. I don't think it's really hit me yet. It won't hit me until all the rest of you guys that are still taking classes go back to classes, and I'm like send you guys off like your last day of school, packing all your lunches and all that.
Mm.
But it's nice to be done for sure.
Yeah.
What drove you to sound for film in particular?
When I was a freshman, I still didn't know what I wanted to do. I chose like film as a major, like as a whole, because I didn't want to do something boring or anything, and I really liked movies. Like, I always enjoyed watching movies and listening to music. But when I was actually outreaching for LKT, my big, she asked me my 5 favorite movies and my 5 favorite albums, and I ratted off like 6 albums immediately, and then was like this movie or this movie, and then like couldn't do it. She was like, you should be an audio major instead. And I was like, huh, that's a good point. So I did sound. Also, there was nobody doing sound when I was a freshman.
Cornering the market.
Yeah, it really was.
That's cool.
And on set, obviously you like to boom up
and sound mix, yeah.
Any preference going into the working world?
Sound mixing, but doing anything going into the working world would be cool.
Well, yeah.
Obviously. But, you know, location sound, I think that... Like, where I would like to end up would probably be doing post,
because
I like sitting and using Pro Tools a lot.
Yeah.
I'm really proficient with it, I'd like to think. But, yeah, whatever. Hire me, please.
That's a good plug. Have you seen anything good lately, movie-wise? This is like a little icebreaking segment we like to do with everyone.
Yeah, I've actually seen a lot of movies, like, over the last week. It's just been that kind of week. Start off with a not good one, because I'm just thinking about it in order in my head.
Go for it.
I saw The Rise of Skywalker.
Oh, yeah.
It was laughable. It was an enjoyable movie watching experience, and that's all I can say for it.
Yeah, I think that's about what I said a couple episodes ago when I saw it.
Mm-hmm. Everybody just kind of been like, yeah, I saw it, like... Okay.
Yeah, it was a movie.
Yeah.
I read an interesting interview with the editor that talked about how rushed the movie was and how sort of dictated by the studio this one was.
I'm surprised they would drop them every 2 years.
Yeah. Well, in this one, they had even less time. Like, it sounds like they really only gave them a little over a year to make this movie, which is insane considering the movie that it is.
Yeah, that sounds ridiculous.
How I don't know.
Is it?
Well, it's almost 3 hours long.
Oh, holy shit.
But it's also the culmination of like one of the biggest franchises.
Yeah.
In like, cinema history.
They only had... Wow, that's insane.
Yeah.
It's the money machine. They got to keep it rolling.
It's kind of written by community stuff. Apparently, J.J. Abrams is really... And like the cast is really pissed off too because they changed a lot in post. Oh. There were whole scenes that were recut to recontextualize and like they changed dialogue and then like CGI'd mouths to like change scenes. So, like they went... like far out.
That's insane.
Yeah. It sucks. But that's the kind of world that we live in now in terms of studio movies.
Amanda and I went to go see Uncut Gems last week.
Yeah. We did.
I loved it.
Yeah.
I thought it was great. I was like sweating by the end of it. My heart was racing. It was really good. The sound design in that film is fantastic. Yeah. I was, because it wasn't one of those movies that I was like, oh, I have to go see that in a theater, because that's when I think of that, I think of, you know, Dunkirk and like huge things like that. But I'm really glad I went to go see it in a theater, because I can't imagine sitting watching it at home on Netflix.
Yeah.
And actually trying to listen to all six conversations that are happening over each other throughout the entirety of the movie.
I think if I had seen it for the first time at home, I would have paused it. Like, and like taken a walk, or, like gotten a snack or something like that,
because
I was so stressed out. Like, I do not get stressed out, and I was like biting my nails off.
Like, not in a bad way, in the best way possible. Yeah. I felt like I was taken hostage in that movie, and I was so glad that I didn't have the opportunity to do anything about it but sit there and keep watching for 2 hours.
Yeah, Safdie Brothers have my vote of approval. I'm real excited for everything they do. I think, I don't remember if I mentioned last week, I may not have, that I saw Good Time, their first movie, and that's a very similar experience. This Uncut Gems is definitely like all of their like power at once, but Good Time is like really, really good. You got to check that one out too if you liked Uncut Gems.
Awesome. When did that come out?
That came out 2017, so pretty recently. Oh, okay. They're really new on the scene, but one of my most excited groups working right now.
A24 just really knows how to pick them.
Yeah,
seriously.
They're killing it. How about you, seen anything?
I mean, we saw Uncut Gems, and then today I watched Drive I watched it. Like, I feel like I've seen the first, like, what is it, 10 minutes so many times of, like, the first time we meet him in that first, like, I guess it's, like, a car chase robbery type thing. And I didn't realize how many times, like, I've seen it, and I knew, like, the beats of it. But I've never sat down and watched the entirety of it, and I really liked it. And it, I mean, compared to the movies I feel like we've been watching a lot recently, like, most of them have been, like, 2+ hours. So Drive was, like, maybe like an hour and a half, so it felt like nothing. And I even, like you said, paused it to like go walk around because I was like stressed out. It was gave me the same kind of like anxious feeling that Uncut Gems kind of did.
It's funny you said that, because I had the opposite. I, for some reason, I was so into the pacing of the movie. I watched Drive for the first time like a month ago, and I was so into the pacing of it that I literally had to go pee so bad, but I didn't want to pause the movie. But I just like went in there and like kept the light off, because the light has that annoying fan.
Yeah.
And so just like,
you could hear it.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's a review right there.
That's Drive, everybody.
Excuse me. I'd be curious to hear your thoughts on his, not his second, but his third movie after that, Nicholas Winding Refn, Neon Demon.
I haven't heard of that.
Really interesting movie, but very sort of polarizing. People either really like it or really hate it. I like a lot of it and then hate a little bit of it. But that's a good like litmus test for a lot of people.
I'll have to check it out. It like reminds me, I put them in the same like genre of like dark, I don't know if it's a driver movie, but what is it, Jake Gyllenhaal's Nightcrawler, I think. Is that a good reaction or a bad reaction?
I see the similarities.
I haven't seen Nightcrawler. I've only wanted to watch it.
It's not really a driver movie. I mean, he has a car.
That movie was marketed so poorly.
Nightcrawler?
I really like that movie too.
Yeah.
But like when I sat down to watch it and then I went back and looked at a trailer for it, it like had like loud hip-hop music and it seemed like a, not really an action film, but something that it wasn't. Like, I thought that I was watching a meme trailer for it because it was just mismarketed so poorly. But
yeah.
Wow.
I mean, it's really, like, there's not a lot of other movies like it. So I can see where, and it was pretty low budget.
Yeah.
Where, like, a cheap marketing team would just have no clue what to do with that.
Tragic. Drive, it looks like such a good movie.
A great pick. Yeah, you should check that one out, too. I was pretty sick this week, especially this weekend. So I'll name a couple of the things I saw. I saw John Mulaney and the Sack Lunch Bunch.
Oh, I heard about that.
Yeah, I heard people talking about that.
That is really fun. I really enjoyed that. It's on Netflix. It's like a kind of a very earnest take on like a children's daytime TV special. Very sort of like Sesame Street without the puppets kind of thing. But it's also very funny. But In a way that like is totally accessible to kids, I think too. Like a lot of it is done by the kids. Mm-hmm. Like there's a lot of musical numbers that are all kids, things like that. And then John Mulaney is kind of the host. Although he's not even really like a host, he's just like this guy who's just kind of hanging out. And a lot of the humor is definitely made for adults, and like kids would laugh at but not really understand, but it's very clever, and the music is really good too. Mm. And that has a Jake Gyllenhaal performance in it.
Oh really? Oh, I think I've seen the memes from it.
It is insane. Like you cannot believe what you're watching,
that it's Jake Gyllenhaal.
Yeah, I really recommend that. And then I watched a couple like really long movies because I was sick. You did the opposite. I intentionally watched some of the longest movies I could. I watched Bridge on the River Kwai, which the first time I watched was a couple years ago when I was very sick. And I really love that movie. It's about this group of British soldiers who are captured by the Japanese, and they have to build this bridge on the River Kwai. And while they're building the bridge, there's a counter plan, I think, by the Americans to blow the bridge up. And they don't know that it's being built by the British. So it's this sort of, not really, it's kind of a race against time at times, and other times sort of like a movie about like endurance and things like that. It's really interesting.
Hmm. How long is it?
It's like almost 3 hours long. Like it's super long. And then I watched this movie called Fitzcarraldo, which is Werner Herzog's like magnum opus, one of his magnum opuses. It is about this eccentric man who tries to bring opera to South America, and so to do that he's going to make it big in the rubber industry. So he is trying to take advantage of one of the only untapped rubber places in the Amazon. It's like traversable water. So to do it, he's going to drag a steamboat over a mountain. So he does just that. Yeah, it sounds pretty crazy. It stars this actor named Klaus Kinski, I think. I can't remember how to pronounce it. He used to be in like every spaghetti western. He was the villain, but he plays this very eccentric weirdo in this movie, and it is super interesting and super weird. I recommend it. I'd never really seen, I think I've only seen one other Herzog film, and his style is very unusual. It's sort of all like all over the place, but he tells the story so masterfully. And so if you're looking for something kind of out of the box, it's also like 2 hours and 47 minutes, but if you're looking for something super out of the box, and definitely worth watching, like there's some really interesting performances and really like interesting messages about like dreams and like what you're willing to do, and also like the good side of what you're willing to do for your dreams, but also the things you can force other people to do and not realize. Which I thought was really, really interesting message.
Oh, that sounds cool. They're interesting movie choices for a sick day in bed.
I've seen some other things, but I'll save them for a future episode.
Yeah. I haven't really, I've just been watching like random TV shows and not liking them, but just like, it's just one in the background where I'm like cleaning my room. Because I just sit there and stare at how dirty my room is. I'm like, maybe I should and put a TV show on in the background, which is nice sometimes. So we were talking about with Natalie, like, the first time she watched The Farther Project was, like, listening to it in the background and then realizing the pacing of it just from hearing it.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm glad that we finally have you on the podcast, because I feel like I end up talking about sound design a lot, and I'm glad that we finally have somebody that's, like, that's your thing.
Yeah. I wish I could do that with movies. But I get in this trap where I literally only put on, like, Family Guy or American Dad if I specifically want background noise.
Mm-hmm.
Because otherwise, I cannot focus on both things. And I really want to focus on both things. Yeah. And I ended up, like, half-ass watching the movie and 1% doing whatever thing I was supposed to be doing.
Yeah.
And then I didn't win at all.
Yeah. I was watching Bob's Burgers, and I was still, like, watching Bob's Burgers and not like doing the things I was supposed to.
I have to put on like YouTube or something like that. I can't put on a show or a movie. It just doesn't work for me. Maybe like show. Like, I used to put on West Wing and listen to it, because it's basically like an audiobook. Like, it's cool to watch, but you also get enough just because of how many words there are.
Yeah.
So I agree with that. Oh, since you mentioned TV shows, one more plug that I'll give really quick is I watched in one day all of Chernobyl, the HBO miniseries.
Oh, shit.
And just won the Golden Globe last night. And it is fantastic. That's all I'll say. Just stop what you're doing and watch Chernobyl.
Yeah, that's on my list because I've never watched an HBO show that I regretted watching.
Yeah.
Mm. Including watching all of Game of Thrones. I still don't regret it.
Yeah, like, same.
But I'm on my second rewatch of The Wire with my roommate, so we can watch it for the first time. And yeah, it's even more rewarding the second time.
Same show. So show, so good.
But like, Silicon Valley is a really funny show. Yeah. Barry's,
oh, I've heard good things about
Barry's
that.
Fantastic. If you haven't seen Barry,
I'm
watch
on the
Barry.
Second season of Barry right now.
Season one's good. Season two is immaculate.
Really? Yeah. Oh, I'm excited. No, yeah. If you don't have an HBO subscription, get a login from somebody.
Yeah, just have a friend.
There's not really a bad
I think five there. People or five friends of mine have my parents, like, DirecTV login.
Makes sense.
If you hire me for sound, I'll give you my HBO login.
Ooh, that's an incentive.
That, yeah, that's a good
hopefully
plug.
Your employer would be able to pay for their own HBO. So that's maybe a bad sign.
I'm just saying.
You don't know in film.
Okay. Fair. Fair enough.
It's one of the many things I bring to the table.
Maybe HBO should be hiring you.
Ooh.
There you go.
The marketing team.
Yeah. Well, are we ready to talk about our second David Fincher movie?
Yes, I'm so excited.
I think it's kind of funny. Is this the first director repeat that we've had?
I think it might be.
Yeah. What was the other one?
Gone Girl.
Yeah.
It was like our second episode or third episode?
I think it was third.
I mean, they're all good. Mementos.
Yeah. Yeah.
Wait, that's the one. I'm so stupid.
Yeah.
Well,
I'll cut that out. Don't worry.
Yeah, cool.
Yeah, most.
Seven's really good.
Yeah. If I cut that out, that's going to sound so out of context.
No, leave it in. Let me sound stupid.
Okay, yeah, no, it's fine. No, I struggle to think of a movie of his that I don't love. Alien 3.
That's not his fault, though, really.
No, it really isn't at all.
I didn't even know there were three of them.
There's more than three.
Oh, shit. Yeah.
There was three when he made one.
Yeah, well, there's two when he made one. I'll leave that one in too, unless you want me to cut that out.
So we're watching, or we watched Fight Club.
Yes, we watched Fight Club.
You seen it? You probably seen it before.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I've never seen it before, and I didn't really know much about it. I didn't know the twist. I just knew that Brad Pitt was in it, and that was good enough.
I'm surprised you didn't know the twist, because this is one of the, like, next to Sixth Sense, one of the, like, more famous twists of really of all time.
Oh, really?
No, yeah, like, everyone knew. It's Fight Club, and it's Sixth Sense, and if you're a little bit more hip, The Usual Suspects, and I'd say those are the three.
Of, like, the modern films. You could name other, like, Psycho and stuff like that.
Oh, yeah. I mean, the only thing I knew about it was, like, the rules of Fight Club that everybody quotes.
It's the biggest, like, meme from it, but there's so much more to it than that.
There is. I found that out.
I'm curious what your thoughts just...
I definitely want you to just
going
go
in.
Because I've seen that movie at least 15 times.
Yeah. Like,
I think this is my third or fourth time. And this is a very different watch for me. Last time I watched it was extremely different compared to the first time I saw it, but this one was also a little different, so I'm curious.
What do you mean?
Every time I have a different reaction to it.
Hmm.
So I'm curious what your thought was.
I don't know. I really, like, I loved every part of it, and I was so, like, I just put it on, and I was like, oh, like, I'm just gonna put it on. It was like we were talking about, like, I put it on just to, like, have one where I was doing other things, because I was thinking that I was gonna just have it on, and then watch it later when I had time to sit down, and then it drew me in within the first like 10 minutes, and I was sitting there like having like clothes folded next to me. But I've been really interested about like voiceovers in film lately, and how they, like, a lot of people are like, oh, are voiceovers like over, are they just telling your story too much? And I really enjoyed it in this film, and I like when films break the fourth wall and just talk straight to the camera. And I enjoyed it also because it made me think about, like, the styles of films and how, like, with film, you can just do, like, you don't have to explain anything. You can just do something, and then it will be accepted as, like, a part of your style of your film, unless it's, like, a mistake or whatever. But a lot of the things that are stylized, I think about this film, help it a lot, and I was so excited to see them, like, where they would just break and talk to the camera and, like, not even acknowledge it as something that was weird. And, yeah, I don't know. It's my
big take. Well, I mean, for the narration, especially, I would say that comes directly from it being a book that's told in the first person. Like, the character's unnamed in the film, other than the fact that the script calls him Jack, and he's just the narrator, like, in the book because of... I mean, so... For the films that we're actually talking about, is it full spoilers territory?
Yeah, I'd say we can go on and okay. for this one. I mean, yeah. It's
also a 20-year-old
plus-year-old movie. Yeah.
I mean, the fact that you never know what Edward Norton's character's name is other than, like, Cornelius, and then the I Am Jack's whatever stuff from the organs is just another small hint of, like, wait a minute, he's Tyler Durden.
I really didn't catch it. If I'm being honest, for like a minute, just because I was enjoying it. And I did not know. Like I said, I really didn't know what the twist was. And so I was starting to pick it up like kind of halfway through. And I was like, this is getting a little sketchy. And then it like confirmed. I was like, nah, it can't be it.
See, I like kind of knew, but like I guess I didn't explicitly know. Like I knew that they were the same person kind of essentially. Mm-hmm. But not to what extent it was. So even then, the reveal was still rewarding to me the first time that I saw it, of like, especially because they go back and they take Brad Pitt out and put Edward Norton in doing the same things. And Norton was like, well, what about when we were both there? And he was like, you just imagine yourself watching me or something. I was like, that's it's clever.
Yeah. And like the way that it starts, I think the way that it started clued me off where it like finally caught up to itself. And then I was like, oh, this is weird. I understand this.
Well, you said you were, like, only half watching it in the beginning of the film.
I had to restart it so I could understand.
So you did restart it. Because there's 4 or 5 instances of just a single frame of Tyler Durden showing up.
Like he's spliced in.
Yeah.
Oh, that's cool.
They're really obvious to me.
They're really obvious once you know that they're there. Yeah. But I can understand someone just watching it for the first time. It may have not, like... clicked.
Especially,
it's like a frame.
I think about one of the notes I had was how interesting the experience must have been watching it in the theater when it came out, because it would have been projected on film in the 90s for those effects, and also for the cigarette burns that he references, because there would have been actual cigarette burns in the film to tell the projectionist when to switch the reels. So I'd be curious to watch with like those put back in, see if it adds anything. Is there some sort of tell? Did he time the movie? I wonder if, and I would assume he would have to in order to include fake cigarette burns in the movie, that when he's explaining that, that's an actual real change.
That'd be fantastic. Yeah. It was. The first time I watched the movie, it was a couple years ago, and I remember watching movies as film in the theater as a kid, and I was always just like, what are those? And never thought anything more than like, oh, it's those little dots in the corner of the screen again. Cool.
I remember, back like, I used to listen to a lot of old-time radio because I had an uncle that was did an old-time radio show broadcasting a lot of old hits, things like that. And there was, like, an old crime show that was, like, someone was communicating through those, and so they explained those. And that was the first time. Wow. So then when I saw it show up in the movie, I was like, oh, wow, I thought that was the only thing that ever, like, used that for some reason. But I'm curious also, like, the story, the themes.
Yeah, the themes is definitely, like,
the themes is what I want to, that's the most notes I have about it, and that's what changes my watch every time.
Oh, yeah. What was your, like, first impression of it? Did you like it? Did you ever not like it when you had watched it?
It's kind of complicated. The first time I liked it a lot, I was pretty early on in high school. And I've come to the conclusion that that's kind of who this movie is for high school boys. I thought I knew the twist because it had been spoiled because, I don't know, probably a book I read or something like that. I don't remember how it would have been spoiled for me. But I still was really blown away by it. I mean, Fincher's style, as we talked about on the Gone Girl podcast, is unbelievable. He commands your attention in like every shot just through the framing, the timing, everything like that. I've always liked Brad Pitt, as I've also mentioned on the podcast before, and he's given a phenomenal performance in here too. but it wasn't until that was when I saw that was probably before I was taking movies apart, really, when I watched them. At least movies that I didn't think were meant to. And this one was, it's very flashy and there's a lot of style. So I never really bothered at that age to really process what it was about. But it's like every time I watch it again, I get really bugged by the themes that I'm not sure where. And people talk about this with movies that I disagree in this point on, where it's commenting on something and where it's glorifying something. Mm-hmm. And I think there's a lot of blurred lines in this movie that
for a lot of different topics, I'd say, too.
I agree.
And there's a lot that I really dislike still. In fact, some of the bigger themes of the movie that I think were intentional, especially for the time it came out, I really disagree on.
That's interesting. I don't know. I wrote down a lot of quotes, I think, just of like one-liners that I was like, oh, like, wow. Like I kept, I feel like, flip-flopping what... like you were saying, like, is it glorifying it or is it just like telling it like it is and being like, this is the way people are and showing them and showing the flaws and being like, we shouldn't be this way. But I was reading through my notes and I feel like the one that stood out the most to me was, this is your life and it's ending 1 minute at a time. And that spoke to me, I feel like, because we're about to graduate and we're sitting with a recent graduate and it feels like, my life is ending, even though, like, it's kind of just starting. Like, I'm about to graduate, about to be an adult, about to start my professional life, but it still feels like I'm wasting my time somehow. And I thought about that throughout the whole movie. Like, what, like, it kind of made me be like, I want to start a fight club. Like, I, like, fuck it. Like, why not? Like, it might be fun. All right, like, I was joking with one of my friends talking about this, like, maybe I just want to start a fight club with Brad Pitt. Like, that would probably be the best case scenario.
Pretty cool.
Especially the Fight Club era.
Yeah.
Now. I do
any
know Brad Pitt.
Any era of Brad Pitt. Thelma and Louise, Brad Pitt.
Yeah.
That, like, is true. I did just watch the climax, or the last scene again of Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, because it came on my timeline this morning. That Brad Pitt could also get a fight club with me. I'm cool with that.
Yeah.
That's true. His Hawaiian shirt wearing ass.
Yeah, definitely. He could throw a can of dog food in my face.
That's true. Oh, yeah, I'd want to start a fight club with Brad Pitt. No, I don't know. I don't know how I feel about this movie now that we're talking about it more. Like, I'm interested to hear your takes on it since you've seen it 15 times.
That's could be hyperbolic, but still, I've seen it plenty.
About, yeah.
I'm trying to think, like, the first time I watched this movie, what stood out to me the most was what, because I was also a high school boy, what stands out the most to is Tyler Durden. Like, he's so charismatic. You're talking about one-liners. I could think of, like, 10 off the top of my head. Like, they're all just so, like, well-written, and they sound cool, even if they might be empty platitudes. Like, self-improvement is masturbation. Like, that's a good line. I enjoy it. You're not your car, you're not your whatever. When he starts looking at the... he turns and looks at the camera. We're the all singing, all dancing crap of the world. We don't have our Greek. Okay, it's all like Tyler Durden was just the fucking man, even though he wasn't the first time I watched it. And then so I watched it, and then I got a little bit older and started thinking more about themes and stuff. And I was like, all right, first of all, is it anti-capitalist, is it pro-capitalist? And I was actually watching an interesting video essay recently about Fight Club, and I think what the theme is trying to be, and I don't know if it quite hits it on the head enough for the audience to know that it's what it's the movie is saying, but it's about finding the middle between being the narrator and between being Tyler Durden. And so in the end of the movie, when he shoots himself in the face to like merge personalities, they're not like the interpretation that the people I was watching had wasn't that he killed Tyler and is just still Jack or the narrator, but that they finally like merged as one in the end to just be a person.
Like, you need to have like, you can't just be one type of person.
Yeah, you can't like, just you be this person who works this dead-end corporate job that means nothing and he has no meaning in his life. But you can't be this, you can't be Tyler Durden either, obviously. You can't be a nigh anarchist either.
You have to find a balance.
Yeah.
Yeah, the movie constantly rides this line of, like, glorifying capitalism, and then, like, and once, like, the Tyler Durden character not just shows up, but things start to really escalate, like, once they're in the house and things like that, is this sort of, like, militarized anarchy. And that's not really the stuff that I take fault with, because I see that sort of, like, being torn between two worlds. And that was a big, like, a lot of big themes of, like, especially the later part of the 90s, too, is this sort of, I mean, people were getting, I don't want to say bored, but there was such a, like, an influx of everything, in a way, that I feel like a lot of these were common themes, unironically. So it was kind of interesting that this novel and then this movie came out in this time. I think the stuff that I have the biggest trouble with is the, like, the themes of masculinity. I think it's trying to weigh everything against masculinity, and I'm not sure the areas where it's challenging it and the areas where it's, like, going with, like, poor themes of, like, toxic masculinity, because it's, like, it's weighing capitalism and masculinity. Let's see, I had a couple other written down. I wish I'd written them all together, but the sort of, like, the impulsiveness, the rage, it's like people are looking for authenticity in life, which I think is a true, and I've said that in other contexts before, and I think it even if the movie's not about it, it represents, like, rage and pain as, like, the most authentic emotion, which I think is what people take away in the worst case from this movie. Like, I don't think it challenges it enough, more than it just gives the wrong people the... This is the type of movie that I feel like if it came out now, people would be afraid of the way people were afraid of the Joker, which I think the Joker is way tamer compared to the themes in this movie, probably because it came way after a movie like Fight Club.
Oh, I would say that I agree that if you are watching this movie on the surface, that you can come away with thinking that, oh, fuck, I need to start a Fight Club to get out this masculine energy. And I think that the movie doesn't want that at all, honestly. But I do think that if you're not really paying attention, and if you're the same type of person to be like, oh, Todd Durden was kind of cool, then you would walk away saying what you're saying, Patrick.
Yeah. And unfortunately, a lot of people took it that way. There were a lot of, like, actual Fight Clubs started. There were a lot of, like, terroristic acts committed that were, like, stemmed back to the movie. people planted, like, pipe bombs and things like that. Even people as young as, like, kids were, like, fighting and, you know, copying it up to, you know, the marketing, or maybe even getting to see Fight Club, things like that. And looking at the style, and especially the style being so new for the time, and the material being so out there, I think it's really easy to see where a lot of people would watch it in that way and, like, just glorify and glean from the surface of this movie.
One of the quotes that I wrote down, like, when everything's kind of starting to get up, he says, after fighting everything in life, the volume got turned down. And, like, I don't know, I can see, I mean, I had just said it myself, I want to start a Fight Club. Like, that surface level, like, just glorifying it and making it look so cool, and seeing them getting, I guess, a release from it. Like, some type of, like, they're getting something from fighting, beating the shit out of each other, like, in the basement. They're getting something from it that they're not getting in their normal life. And people could watch that and be like, well, I feel the same way. Like, I feel dead in this, like, horrible in this dead-end job. Like, I need something else to get that energy out. And I guess it is a lot of rage. And it was interesting, like, the way that they treat, like, gender roles. Where he says, like, what is it? Is another woman really the answer we need? Like, we were brought into this world from a woman. Do we really need to add another one to the equation? And, like, those kind of remarks throughout the movie kind of made me, like, not like it as much. And I don't know if it's, like, because stuff from that era and even stuff from like the early 2000s, like when we talked about Superbad, the stuff that they were saying in there is like, oh, it's of that era, but it like, was it ever okay to say that stuff, or was it ever okay to really think like that or have that mentality? And so, like, what do you guys think about?
I think it's important that it's Tyler who's saying it.
Yeah.
First of all, I mean, we can get into this. The movie has overtones of homoeroticism, like, which is part of it for sure. Like, I think my favorite part of the movie is them on the bus looking at the Calvin Klein ad, and Tyler being like, you know, that's not what people look like. Mm-hmm. And then this next shot is him jacked, shirtless, like in a fight in a Fight Club, looking exactly like that ad is. When the owner of the bar comes down and beats the shit out of Tyler, he's getting like pleasure from it. Like,
Fincher's really into that stuff too, in putting that type of stuff in the movies. He's got that famous interview where he says like the audience is perverts, so he just puts like this stuff in there that like people intentionally like get all these weird like unintentional messages from.
I mean, we learn about like the beginning of film was, I mean, film is kind of voyeuristic in a sense. You're watching people do stuff like to the dumbest sense,
but back to your point about another woman. Shit, I totally had one too when I got sidetracked by myself. I love when I do that. You were talking about the
another woman, what we need.
Oh yeah, okay, perfect. Another thing, another theory slash hot take of what this movie's is, okay, so this all starts when the narrator meets Marla, and there's a disconnect between Tyler and the narrator with Marla, which is a huge part of the movie, is that when they're having sex, the narrator isn't mentally there, and it's just, it's Tyler off having sex with Marla, but any other time they interact, it's as the narrator. And a lot of it has to do with his need for a human, the narrator's need for a human connection, and he's, Tyler is fighting that in the narrator. So with a line like that, that's Tyler using like the Fight Club and then Project Mayhem, but then just like trying to control the narrator, being like, is another woman what we need? Because that wouldn't work well for what Tyler's plan is, even though that's exactly what the narrator needed, was a romantic connection with someone.
Yeah, that's an interesting point. It does have a, like, I'm interested by Helena Bonham Carter's character, Marla, because she has a very tricky role to play, because she's given both a lot of stuff and also nothing to do in the movie, which is another line that I think plays into that really well that I wrote down, was in, like, one of his big monologues down in Fight Club, is he says that we're a generation of men raised by women. Which I think is really there, as much as there is a the message of masculinity, there's this message of emasculation too, where, you know, that just about the there's another one, they're slave to men with white collars. I had another one, but like this sociopathic masculinity too, where it's just, you know, the obsession with the self, and they're always blaming their problems on other people, things like that.
I think
it's really interesting.
The beginning, which is what made me like stop and restart the movie, the him going to all of the like, oh, what are they called? Like the support groups. That's so interesting to me.
Yeah.
Like to have, he can't, what is, he goes because he can't,
he starts the movie with insomnia.
Yeah,
and he can't sleep, so he goes to these places, but then it's also like this is the only place that he feels emotion, but it's when he's faking it, and then he becomes like the fakest, I quotes, fakest version of like, I guess, a man that he could be, but it's like his idealized version of it. Like, I don't know, the beginning still doesn't really make, not make sense, but like, I guess it's the way that he meets Marla. So that makes
sense. Again, it's the search for authenticity and the search for like true release. And so the like the contrast that it's almost trying to present is that is the like the truest expression of emotion through like sympathy and sadness, and like when he's crying in the support groups, or is it the rage and the, you know, the fear that he gets when he's, you know, beating the life out of another person in Fight Club?
Mm-hmm. Like,
it's the contrast, I think, is what it's trying to bring up.
Yeah, like it is interesting too, like the way, like why he needs to be there, and or like why he chooses to do that instead of like going to the gym or like going somewhere else, is that he goes to support groups for diseases that he doesn't have, to listen to people. Because I think he was saying, like, he says a line about like people really listen to you when they think like you're about to die or like they're dying or something, like mm-hmm. people don't listen in the normal life, in like regular day life.
Yeah,
I think that it's still more than about this human connection that he's just, for some reason that's not necessarily explained, that he's just lacking mm-hmm. in his life. And obviously so is Marla, which is why she was doing the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
They're both looking for the same
thing. I mean, the throwaway line is just go to the support group if you want to see real pain. So that's how it starts. And I guess it just works out that he chooses to do something that has these human connections mm-hmm. and he gets his release from it.
Yeah. What do you think about like the Bob character?
Oh,
he's a tricky character for me too.
Yeah, I don't know, because I feel like he is supposed to be like not a symbol of being emasculized.
Oh,
but
I think he
like,
totally is.
Yeah.
No, 100%.
Like he kind of, yeah. I don't want to say it, but he like, in a sense, he's like, I guess, a paradox, because he's like this huge guy that used to be what, like a bodybuilder or yeah. something, mm-hmm. like a heavyweight lifter, and now he's like crying and like he doesn't have balls. It's like the ultimate mm-hmm. emasculation that he has testicular cancer
and bitches.
Or whatever.
Yeah.
Oh yeah, that's true. I forgot about the bitch tins. But what do you think about it?
No, I think that's yeah. entirely it. And I'm not really sure what you're supposed to get from his character, which is weird because he never really respects Bob. I mean, he's sad when he dies at the end, but I never feel that he totally respects him like in a genuine way.
I would say that, if I mean, I see what you mean for sure, and I think to a point he doesn't like fully respect him, but I think that if he didn't, then he would have let him walk away from Project Mayhem. Mm. And
that's
that would
true.
Have been the end of it.
Yeah, I don't know, there's something about like their relationship that's kind of interesting, I think, solely based upon what Bob sort of represents. and I guess maybe in character he is supposed to, on at least on the surface, deny the sort of sensitive, emasculated character. But I don't know, just his depiction maybe is a little strange for me. Some of it rings a little odd.
No, I agree with you. It feels like he doesn't, like, he just seems to be a one-dimensional character, and I feel like he doesn't really get an arc per
yeah.
se. Like, he does a little bit where he like doesn't walk away from, well, I mean, he does walk away from Project Mayhem, but he like stays there and goes through the trials and gets in. But
well, his arc, unfortunately, is that he's in the support group and his wife and kids have left him because mm-hmm. he got testicular cancer, which is the like the worst story in the world. But then that he gets so involved with Project Mayhem because it's like the only family that he has, and that's
yep.
really what he's searching for,
mm-hmm.
which is an like an interesting arc. But again, the fact that he dies for it at the end is also interesting.
Yeah, I mean, like, obviously this should be like, they're all yearning for some connection, and the connection that they like feel like they need to have is punching each other in the face instead of like talking about it. Like, maybe like the support group is what they needed, was to talk about things and to have a place to talk about things, but the only way that I guess society lets well, I mean, I guess that's what it's about, is that society only lets men express their emotions in rage or sadness, or like none of the,
I'd say it's
like
not in the sadness
way. Not in the sadness.
That's,
well,
the comment.
Like the all of the emotions that go along with that, like, I don't know, I feel like the rage and the pain, I guess pain is the word that I meant mm-hmm. more than sadness, is that they're trying to express that but they can't.
Yeah,
the whole thing,
so they choose to through violence.
something that you had said earlier, like finding the middle ground or like finding a balance. Like even he says, like, we're the middle children of history. Like we don't have a big war to fight. Like our war is a spiritual war. But it makes me think about arguments that I have with my dad a lot, which are, there's a difference, I feel like, between middle ground, but a difference between a middle ground and a balance, because I feel like a middle ground is compromising, and sometimes compromising is just means like compromising is just like the worst end of both, but finding a balance is like what I feel like he finds in the end, which is a balance of, I guess, his two personalities, or like what he wants to be and what he is.
Yeah.
And he finds like a confident balance. But like the middle ground, like his whole big speech, which is like the middle children of history, like feeling that forgottenness is what drives their rage, which is interesting. I don't know what I'm trying to say, but I was just thinking about that.
Yeah, that's a good point. I think it's a difficult movie to talk about little sections, because I think each thing plays into a lot of the grand arcs, obviously intentionally. But it's sort of a movie on a scale where it's constantly balancing and unbalancing itself. So it's hard to take apart one little piece at a time.
And I like another part that I was thinking about was he always has to be in, like, he has to be in control of things, but everything is so totally out of control. Like, it seems like it'll go back to like him sitting in the office, and just it feels like he was like glowing when after he started the fight club and he started to get all these bruises on his face, and like they wear them as badges of honor, and like instead of being drab and gray in his boring office with his boss yelling at him all the time.
Yeah, there's almost not a lot of color at all.
There isn't.
Until you start to see like the blood and things like that, which is interesting. Speaking of the office, the poor boss, that scene where he like beats himself up and like blames on the boss is pretty rough. I think the scene where he threatens to shoot up the office doesn't age very well at all. I was uncomfortable during that. And I think you were supposed to be at the time, but now it's really, uncomfortable. Yeah, that had happened like 2 times when that movie came out. That's a little rough now.
Amanda, how'd you not get the twist about that point in the movie? Because I feel like that's when it smacks you in the face with it.
Oh, really?
When he confronts his boss in his office and then beats himself up, and he says, for some reason, I thought of my first fight with Tyler.
Oh, that does make sense.
To me, it's when they have the same briefcase. I'm like, there's...
See, immediately you're like...
Well, we've already seen the Flash.
Mm-hmm.
We've seen the Flash of him, and it's like, we have the same briefcase, and then he's everything he's not. I'm like, okay, he's made up.
Mm. That doesn't make sense now. I mean, I... Like, you guys had gone into it. I mean, I guess it is kind of obvious. I should have known. I feel stupid.
I mean, it's not even like, how could you not? But I feel like that's when the movie, like, is like, all right, guys. Like,
yeah.
Hello. Pay attention to this.
I mean,
it just felt like they were just saying, pay attention. This guy's important. Yeah. Oh, this guy's really important.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I don't want to say that the movie stops being interested in hiding it, but it's like...
No, I could see that. Like, towards the end.
It's got bigger things on its mind. I guess it's just sort of assuming you've figured it out at a point. But, I mean, if you haven't, I guess the impact is even better. So, more power to you in some way.
Go ahead.
No, go ahead. You have notes. I'm just
freestyling. No. Go ahead.
Because I was going to, like, switch gears a little bit.
Go for it.
The action in the movie. Whether or not if it's the thematically and what it's glorifying or not, just on a more surface level, honestly, like the brutality of the fights, like how did you feel watching them?
Oh, I looked away a lot. I mean, that's just a personal thing because I don't, like, I hate watching like MMA fights or like any of the stuff where people actually beat the shit out of each other because I just feel horrible. And I did look away a couple times when it got like, especially when the... What is it? The manager comes down and he like finally says something. Like that one, I was like, oh shit, like I gotta walk away for a second.
For me, it's, I mean, that one's really bad. It's definitely something too that as I've gotten older, like the more I cringe at things that are very violent like that.
Oh, really?
Like, for example, in The Joker, like, there's not that much violence in it, but when it does happen, I was like, wow. Mm-hmm. If I was a kid when I watched that, I'd been like, it's just a movie. But it, now, as more of an adult, to put context to things, I was like, Jesus Christ. Mm-hmm. But, like, when he beats the shit out of Angel Face, Jared Leto's character.
I didn't like that one. And then you see his face after.
Yeah.
Like, it's even worse than I thought it was going to be.
It's almost worse when you see him later in the movie, like, all scarred over than when you see him, like, all bloody.
Yeah, that's
like
what I mean. Because
the blood almost masks like how bad it really is. Although there's his teeth.
Yeah, his teeth are all messed up.
That's the part that's worth. The amount of times you see somebody with a messed up tooth or pulling a tooth out or.
Yeah.
I don't like when people. I've had too much dental work done to watch any of that without.
Or he like spits a tooth out.
Yeah.
Oh, that's awful.
But then I would say, because the movie is so visceral, that it would speak to it not being pro violent, because they're hard to watch. Like,
yeah.
And this movie. Is from, is it 97 or 99? 99. So 20 years ago. Like, so I'm sure audiences then were like,
whoa.
What? Like, yeah.
Still, it's something to the point of the people who still, after watching this, were like, that looks really fun. Start one of these.
That's true.
You apparently being one of them.
Yeah. No, I think it was just the Brad Pitt factor.
Blindfolded, would you be fine?
Yeah.
The Brad Pitt factor is... very weighs heavily on that. But
hard to fight with one, like with your hands or your eyes or closing your eyes.
That's true. But I also think, like, it felt like they didn't show a lot of, like, the fights. Like, yeah, they showed people punching each other, but, like, most of it was on the other person's face, like the person who was, like, I guess, winning at that time. Mm-hmm. Like, it, like, especially when he beats up Jared Leto's character, like, you don't see him until it's, like, the end where he's all bloody and everything. Like, you see him over top of him, which I feel like is a lot of the fights.
I think it's because of that release, that catharsis that they're all getting through that. It's really trying to show that, which I think it's an interesting way.
I'd say that, as well as the plot reason, that the only reason the narrator is going so hard, like, he says, I want to destroy something beautiful, but he was jealous of himself too, which is crazy, because there's the scene before that, they're doing the job at the restaurant that Talia works at, the Project Mayhem mission, and at the end of it, when they're running away, Tyler just roughs up Angel Face's hair, and the narrator gets jealous of it, and then the next scene is the fight of him beating the ever-lover shit out of him.
Yeah, Angel Face is an interesting character, especially with Jared Leto.
Especially when he says you're not going to be movie stars or rock stars, and it just so happens that Jared Leto spikes the camera, like, when he says that, pretty much.
Yeah, Jared Leto is an... I'm not a fan of Jared Leto. That's partially because in real life, he's kind of an asshole and a creep, but he's, like... a weird character here. When did you just saw Requiem for a Dream? When did that come out?
Oh, it was the 90-something, right? It was the early 2000s.
I'm going to say 04 based off of my head, but I could be wrong. I like Mr. Nobody. That's weird looking up stuff, but...
2000. So it came out a year after this movie.
Yeah.
Which makes it interesting. I wonder if he would have been cast by the time this movie, he probably would have made this movie maybe before, because this would have had a lot of post-production, so it's possible that word of mouth from this movie could have helped him get Requiem for a Dream. But I don't know, it's an interesting part that's kind of a little bit of something, a little bit of nothing, because he is almost literally a punching bag for a lot of it.
He stands out so much, I feel like.
He's against just so everybody intensely, else. Like, off-putting.
Blonde. He's too fucking blonde! Yeah.
Really blonde. That is true. They do make him... I think he has black hair in Requiem for a Dream.
Which, I think naturally he does.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
I mean, I don't think you could have the hair of that goddamn blonde.
That is so much bleach. Yeah. No. Were there any, like, big... Before we, like, completely shift topics again... Anything else? We've kind of been talking about everything. We haven't really been focused on one.
I liked all of the little... I always think it's funny when, like people, I guess, okay, I guess it came out in the early, in the late 90s, and Brad Pitt, I guess, wasn't that big to have.
He wasn't that big yet.
He wasn't though, this Brad, like our Brad Pitt big, but
I'd say that, yeah.
It was a bunch, there were so many lines that were little nods to like movies, like the movie goes on and then audience has no idea, or like they're literally talking straight to the camera about movies or just things like that, where that they interest me so much to have like Brad Pitt say them, or like just the context of it, and to put that in a movie, and what, like calling, we always talk about how like movies take us away into like a different place, and like we enjoy that, but it's interesting to me when they like call back and be like, you are watching a movie, like pay attention right now, or like when they talk about the little flashes of like him putting like flashes of like junk or like porn in between like the projector slides, and then having that like little slide at the end, like just a nod back to it. And then you were saying they has little flashes of it in the beginning of like them meeting each other, but I guess my point is, do you like when movies kind of call attention to it being a movie, or do you think, and specifically this one, I feel like it is different
than, and this one others. I find it very interesting,
the
way that they do it. I think it has to do with the tone of the movie and the tone of the book too, like it's definitely talking to an audience in that way, so I think it works, and it just like making it more movie oriented for the film, also I think it works. I think it's really interesting, and in general when movies do it, it's, I mean, it's, they're usually comedies, so it's fine.
Yeah, I think it's interesting too. I think lately, as especially humor, like you said, has gotten very meta, I think it can be kind of a crutch now to break the fourth wall. But movies that do it earnestly, I think, are interesting. I mean, the famous ones are like Ferris Bueller and things like that. But to have a like a drama that uses it almost to put you on edge, or to really play into the sort of strange psychological elements of it, is interesting, especially given the twist in this movie. So, I mean, I'm a fan of it. I think one of my favorite effects in the movie is when Brad or Tyler Durden is talking about how he's losing his grip on reality, and the film starts to shake, but he stays still, which is really interesting. And again, is another like sort of tell in a weird way, and also is another time where I think it would be really interesting to be watching that in a theater, on actual film, and the fake film starts to shake.
That would be really cool.
Just to see that big would be really cool.
That's true,
because that's such an impressive effect.
It's tragic my parents didn't take me when I was one when this came out.
I mean, really,
No one really saw this movie when it came out. I don't know if you know that, but it was a box office bomb.
Really?
Yeah, it's a cult classic for sure.
Oh yeah,
in the sense that it, I mean, it wasn't maybe not like a bomb, but it didn't do well, and critically it didn't do great, and then it DVD sense. Word of mouth.
I feel like this had to have been like a huge poster child for like the blockbuster revolution, where like this was probably every
someone's like, oh my god, I just watched Fight Club, you gotta check this movie out.
Every college dorm and then every blockbuster near a college was probably just swamped with people looking for Fight Club.
That's kind of crazy that that's how it started, because given the Fight Club of it.
This is a movie, another one of those movies that it's like, if you were to do set design for like a college boy's dorm room, you got to put a, like a Pulp Fiction and a Fight Club poster up, and maybe like a Full Metal Jacket or something to really complete the trilogy of like teenage, like college age boy movies.
I feel like that's why I haven't watched this movie, because I didn't grow up with like the typical film movies being like, oh, you have to watch this. And so when I got to college, it was like, this was the like Pulp Fiction, like you were saying, then this movie, were like, oh my god, you're a film kid, like if you say these are your favorite movies, blah 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 blah.
I love Pulp Fiction, don't get me wrong.
I like this movie a lot, and I love Pulp Fiction, and I cringe to say it because it's just a meme, but I also think those are like,
they're amazing,
they're good movies. No, the problem is that they're really good movies, but like they're stereotypically good movies.
Yeah, they're imitated, and they're to the point where like you can hate movies and love those movies. So it's so, they're so too, almost too accessible.
Yeah, exactly. They're just like not unique answers, which is why it's...
Yeah.
But it doesn't mean they're bad movies, because they're not.
I went to the Film One screenings this year, and I only stayed for like half, and I shit you not that there were, I think, I'd have to ask some of the people I went with, three Film Ones, like separate Film Ones that had like Pulp Fiction posters.
Really?
That's because most of these are filmed in dorm rooms. But like, my goodness, if you were to make a bet, you couldn't have guessed how many Pulp Fiction posters were like full view. One, they even talk about going to like, it's like, you know, this guy trying to get a date. And he's like, you come to my place and we could watch Pulp Fiction. And like the whole like auditorium was like, oh my God, please. Yes, we're in film school.
It's tragic.
We talked about the special effects a lot in the Gone Girl podcast.
Mm-hmm.
Let's go into them with this one. I don't think they age well in this one. I think it's they're really revolutionary, and I'm sure they were at the time. But I think these, unlike the other Fincher movies, call attention to themselves so much, and just based on like what year this movie came out, they don't work for me anymore.
What do you mean? Like, what specifically are you talking about?
All of where the camera is moving around through like the oven.
Those. Yeah. Okay, yeah.
I mean, it's not that, because I forgive age.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah.
Which is why, like, it's like, oh, you're right. They don't work anymore. The moving through the oven and stuff doesn't work anymore as far as a believability. But it's like, all right, it's. I just forgive. I forgive age.
I mean, it made me think about the beginning of Drive, where they're like going through the like car engine or whatever. Yeah. Like the.
They really... do that in a Fast and Furious movie.
Oh God.
I think the most interesting thing is the sex scene.
Yeah, that one's pretty interesting. The like slow-mo blurred.
This could be talking out of my ass, but I'm pretty sure they like were doing some Matrix type. Camera stuff with
probably
the sex scene
where they have like 20 cameras all rigged up in a big circle and they just simultaneously record and then just like morph it and do weird stuff in post.
Why though?
Again, Fincher does, especially the camera moving around through things is like not weird for him. Like literally almost all of his movies do that. Especially like the other one that probably more famous because I think the effect still holds up to this day is Panic Room, where the camera goes through the whole house and it goes through like a coffee maker handle and all. It's like showing off how impossible, but it always in his other movies feels like, I don't know, it feels like it's supposed to be there, like it feels like it's necessary the way he's telling the story. And this one, maybe it's because of how showy this movie is, it just feels unnecessary. And then there's also like three or four, there's a couple other times where the camera just does really weird, impossible. A lot of them are towards the very beginning. But whether they're in the house or there's the really famous one in the building. I think it's in the one of the opening shots where it's like going through the building to the van. Or no, maybe it's towards the end.
Yeah. I know it's when you talk about, because then it goes up down the floor. Yeah.
And the van, like that whole shot is 100% CGI. And I think it's really obvious because there's like almost no reflections on anything. Like it's how things were done in the 90s. But I don't know. This one just felt of Fincher's style, but out of character for the film.
I know what you mean. It does, like, it has a weird, not fake quality, but like,
fabricated is also fake.
Those,
but it's fancier fake.
Yeah. Like, I guess it plays into the sense of like it's not his dream world, but like in a sense it is his dream world. Like it's what he want. Like he wants the excitement of his life, so he's making these things happen because he needs the excitement in his life. So I guess the like quality of it being a lot of CGI could add into it.
Yeah,
but I see what you mean.
There's some that works. I think that like one of my favorites is like when he's talking about all the like his almost like IKEA lifestyle and all the words are popping
up. It made me
up.
Think of Scott Pilgrim at that time, where it was like they little do the same things thing. Popping up and being like, this is like, and introductions.
There's probably plenty of other effects that are there, typical Fincher style, and we don't even notice them, like to paint out backgrounds or maybe other like natural camera moves that, you know, there's gear stuff in the shot. But just compared to his other movies that like do the flashier stuff better, like I think, and again in Gone Girl I mentioned Zodiac, like almost all of the backgrounds, like the settings are completely CGI'd. Like it, I don't know, it just was a little disappointing watching this and like really seeing the cracks in that stuff. I don't know.
How many films had he made by that point?
This is his third, like, feature, like, big feature, because it was Alien 3 and then Seven's next, right?
Yeah, because so that was 97.
Yeah, so then this is the third one. And I can't think of anything super flashy in Seven as far as...
No, me neither.
So maybe this is his first time trying it
out. Probably doing the big stuff, which would make sense about this time in, like, special effects history. But you're right, Seven is pretty... bare as far as there's probably
because stylistically it's different.
There's probably it's some very subtle ones.
It's so neo noir that it doesn't. I don't think it would fit the same way.
That's very true. But yeah, I guess before then it was just like his music videos because he did those forever, and then his special effects work, like I mentioned in the other podcast. So yeah, still an impressive movie for his early on in his career as it is. I will say that again. He'd been exposed to filmmaking for a while. Definitely honed his craft before he was really. Making features, which I think is really admirable. He's got a new movie they just announced coming to Netflix.
I heard that.
In 2020.
Oh, really? Yeah. It is 2020.
Yeah.
We got a lot of time, though.
I don't know. They just announced their whole, like, not their whole, but, like, for the first half of the year, all the movies that they're putting out.
And he's already been dealing with Netflix for forever anyway, so it's not surprising that he just dropped the film.
Yeah, he did Mindhunter, and, I mean, he's worked with Netflix all the way since House of Cards.
But, yeah, he was,
he was a producer for a while, House of Cards, and directed.
He's the one who got the show, like, really started.
Yeah. He might have directed the pilot. He was, like, really hit the ground running with that show. Anything else? Again, we already talked about how some of the stuff is kind of dated. Oh, I caught a weird Lorena Bobbitt reference, this time. And again, it was kind of talking of the masculinity and emasculation too. He makes a Lorena Bobbitt reference and in the reference of could be worse, like, again, having your dick cut off could be worse.
It made me think of...
which is kind of strange. It was kind of strange hearing a reference like that now, but then also, like, in context, what that kind of means.
Those type of scenes made me think of the movie... Oh, I think it's Candy with Ellen Page. Have you guys ever seen that or heard of it? It's like a take on Little Red Riding Hood, where Ellen Page's character goes after the people who killed, I think, her like best friend and like sexually assaulted her and stuff. And like the whole big thing is like it's a torture scene with like she like cuts off his balls or like pretends to. And so it, I don't know, just like thinking about. Especially the like support groups, like the actual support group about like not having balls and like testicular cancer and like that stuff, and then how when they talk about, I mean, they talk about the like mom part, but then they talk about if our fathers bailed, what does that say about God? And then like like paternal relationships.
Our fathers and, like, are our what is it? Our models for God.
Yeah, something like that. I don't know. I'm interested to hear what that aspect of it was like for you guys, like thinking about the allusion that they make to like the image of God or like how they think of like patriarchal role models in their life and stuff like that.
When I, because like my views have shifted so much just in life between the first time I've seen this movie until when I watched it a couple weeks ago. Because, like, now when I watch this movie, as much as I think the dialogue is well-written, and that really goes to the author of the book, because a lot of it is from there. Like, it just, it's all, like, everything that Tyler Durden says is bullshit. Like, and that's, and, like, just knowing that he's
There's seeds of truth.
I mean, there's seeds of truth for sure.
At times.
But, like, it's coming from a psychologically damaged man who thinks he's another also psychologically damaged man.
Yeah.
So, like, it's... I think I thought less about, like, the bigger picture of what he's saying because it's... To me, it's not what the movie's about anymore, like, on a deeper level. Like I said, I enjoy the dialogue a lot. I think it's snappy and, like, witty, and I think that Tyler Durden says cool-sounding things.
Oh, and it's Brad Pitt.
And it's Brad Pitt.
Anything.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But, so...
Yeah, I mean, Tyler Durden is definitely sort of, like, the id of the narrator's character, and I think the point of making him that is that, and especially of casting Brad Pitt, that was so genius, is that... sort of like that id, it's supposed to sound like the smartest thing in the room, it's supposed to sound like the right answer, and I think of anything, like, that is an interesting point, the fathers are image for God kind of thing, and that almost is the one of the only sort of true things that he says, because it kind of in a way explains the behavior of a lot of the men in the movie with like the emasculation and the masculinity and the misogyny and things like that, because I think that comes in the same scene, if not the same breath, as the we're generation of men raised by women kind of thing. Yeah, I totally agree with that, that a lot of the stuff he says sounds really wise. It's sort of like comic book wisdom, in a sense.
That's true. I think the last thing I have to talk about is the ending, I guess.
Oh, that's where I was going to go.
Great.
Yeah.
Great. I'm glad we're all there. I kind of hate that they end up together. I don't know. I guess they do end up together, I guess, but I don't know. It didn't pay off, I guess, for me. I was just like, okay, I guess they're together.
In what way did it not pay off?
Like, I don't know. It felt like such a, like, it felt like it had to happen. Like, it kind of was forced, like, oh, it's this, like, I knew from the beginning that they were going to end up together. And I was just like, okay. Like, the rest of it was such, like, not knowing the twist. Like a big twist, being like, whoa, this is crazy. And then to have that part, it was just like, okay, yeah, I forgot we have to add that part in. But like, I liked the entire ending up to that, where like everything blows up around him.
And then when Where's My Mind comes in, it's yeah. perfect. It's literally iconic now at this point. I don't know. Yeah. I like it because of the interpretation that the movie's about, that the narrator needs someone, and then he realized that he has. Needed her.
Yeah.
I mean, and she thought that she was dating him the whole time.
Yeah.
So.
And he realizes too late.
Yeah.
Because of he's already put in motion what he's done. I think the problem is that that's the scene in the movie that puts the people who are, if they're on the fence about interpreting this movie wrong, really puts them over the edge. Because you put him getting the girl, and then you get the cool shot with the buildings falling, and then the Great Pixies song. And you're like, okay, like...
I know what I have to do.
Yeah. And that's exactly what people did.
Yeah.
Because, you can't deny that is a great ending and takes the movie out on a high.
I mean, I definitely like it better than the ending to the novel, which is that he wakes up and thinks he's in heaven, but it's highly implied that he's actually just in, like, a sane asylum or something.
Yeah. I guess that one is a little more...
It's a little bleak. It's definitely not audience ready.
It's almost too clean, too. Like, this one is very ambiguous.
Yeah. In a way, too. That's true.
Because you have to think, like, not only do they probably get to start life together, but to me, the implications of... I guess they won, right? Like, they erased the world's debt. It's like, there's a lot of implications there.
I mean, it just seemed... Like, I guess it seemed weird because after the twist, making it... Like, everything just seemed like a fantasy then, and then to have it end like that was just, like, a huge fantasy happy ever after kind of thing, and it felt, like, tonally off, I guess, to the rest of the movie, but I guess, I don't know, now that I'm saying that, I guess it doesn't, because it feels like the whole thing is really, like, it is his fantasy of what he wants, like, life to be, life exciting and everything, and so it ends that way, and that makes sense.
I mean, I've definitely, and I think this is wrong, but I've seen people interpret it that he does actually kill himself instead of shooting himself in the face, and that after that it is like a happy ending dream.
Yeah.
And I don't agree with that, but I've heard that.
I think it's kind of open to your interpretation.
Yeah, which is totally fine.
It is also a little odd that he shoots himself in the face and it comes up the side of his cheek. I've never...
Yeah, that part was weird too. Or like I thought he was just going to exist. Like I guess I do take that interpretation of that. He did kill himself, I guess, mm-hmm. is that he shot himself and then everything else was just like... Oh, everything will turn out perfect because I'm imagining it because it's not real.
I mean,
it
yeah.
never would happen.
I think
I've, which is why I think it's like a valid one. I just...
Yeah. I've also read that interpretation that he actually died there. And I think the justification it had was it comes out of his cheek because like if the bullet bounced off like your brain or something, that's where it would come out. And so the idea is that like it's his brain, like his sick, like double mind, like spitting the bullet out in a sense. So I don't know. I think either way is valid.
Mm-hmm.
Whatever.
I like that interpretation better.
Yeah.
Okay.
End your own movie.
I have a fun question for you guys.
I'm excited.
If you had to fight one historical figure, who would it be?
Ooh. He says so many funny. The worst one is when he says Gandhi. Lincoln is another funny answer that he gives.
Yeah,
too.
Yeah.
Lincoln's a great one. I can't remember all the. I wish I had a list of. Because they go through that conversation several times.
I know.
In the movie. Oh, geez, that's a good one. And I love when he's like the living or living or dead.
Yeah.
Do you have one?
Yeah.
I feel like you do.
No, actually, I said it because I had the idea while we were sitting here talking. I'm like, all right, let me end with this. But
that's a tough one because it's one of those questions where it's like you could say something funny and it'd be like, yeah, that actually sounds kind of bad that I would fight that person. You know?
Oh, yeah, you'd have to
Jesus?
And then it sounds, well, kind of person does that make me?
Yeah.
That kind of thing. I don't know. And then, but you don't want also don't want to be the person to be like Hitler. Like,
yeah, no, because that's, yeah, that's played out.
Yeah, you got to have a very complicated answer.
I feel like I'd like to fight the inventor of something stupid. I don't know what. Like,
yeah.
I don't know. Everybody makes the jokes of, like, I'd like to fight the inventor of calculus, because how dare they?
Yeah, exactly.
Isn't that just Isaac Newton?
I think it...
Wait, no.
Yeah.
No.
I do think scientists could fight. Because I think calculus
is actually... Oh, do you?
Maybe.
You know what? I would fight
Would it be Isaac like? Newton. Would it be like in Sherlock... Have you seen the Robert Downey Jr. Sherlock Holmes movies?
Yes.
So he's like a really good fighter.
Yeah.
Because his brain works so good that he can just process how things have to happen and like predict.
Slow motion.
Yeah, and understand physics.
So and he predicts like, what
it's going to do. Oh, if I punch you. Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Because when Guy Ritchie gets a movie like that, he can't just take a character that's known for his brain and not have him also fight. He's got to use that to justify why he's so amazing at fighting. His movies are more comic book movies than anything I've ever seen. And they're based off of classic British literature, which is hilarious for the wrong reasons. But I'd fight Isaac Newton, and I'd fight him solely with apples.
Oh my, that's a good one.
Yeah, that's good. I feel like I'd want to fight Albert Einstein just... So are we all just going to
choose?
Well, I brought up the scientist thing.
Yeah, famous scientist.
Because I feel like they would be the easiest to fight. But then you brought up the point that they could just understand things better and then understand fighting better. But
I don't think the big brain. Like, it'd be an easier target.
Oh, that's true. I think that I would fight John Wilkes Booth.
Ooh.
And
that's a good
not
one.
Just solely because he assassinated Lincoln. But I think he's probably a bitch.
Oh, no, he was. I think that's why he assassinated Lincoln.
Yeah, he assassinated Lincoln because he was a bitch.
That's true.
And so
I did a report on him. Like, he was a huge bitch before he assassinated
Lincoln. So I just, like, try to punk him, and then maybe he would be really sad and just not
maybe he'd assassinate himself.
Or maybe I do in the future, and he gets so angry, and he assassinates Lincoln because he lost in a fight to me.
Interesting.
Conspiracy.
Guys, is this a movie?
Yeah. One of those historical events that actually you caused trying to prevent.
I feel like the only person who could play that person would be Nicolas Cage. Like, I feel like that would make sense.
The person who fights
John
Smooth to it. Okay.
Yep. Like, if you were to write that movie, it would be Nicolas Cage.
I think that happened. Wasn't that National Treasure Book of Secrets.
Something like that. It was
yeah.
Close enough.
Pretty sure he fights John Wilkes. There's something about Nicolas Cage and John Wilkes Booth in that movie, and I can't quite put my finger on it.
It could be that they fight. It could be that they possibly don't. You don't know.
It could be that one started, like, a secret code system. I don't... It's been a long time since...
Maybe another podcast episode.
Maybe.
That would be an interesting... We did a double feature last week. Both National Treasure movies. Very fun now that we're saying that out loud.
All that Nick Cage.
Yeah. That's most of the notes that I have, mm-hmm. other than, like, little lines that we've talked about. Oh, there's a lot of... Most of the quotes are in the soap lie scene. Let's talk about... This is a very visceral movie, too.
Yeah.
And very disgusting in a lot of... The two I think of the most are... I do wince when he does the chemical burn test. But when they're stealing the fat for the soap...
Oh,
and the bag cuts Rips on the barbed wire yeah. fence and spills all over him. Oh, man.
He doesn't even seem to care. I think that's the worst part, is that he's trying yeah. to, like, catch it, too. Like, he's like, oh, no. Like, let me put it back in the bag.
I'm
like,
well, and it's just the two of them, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'd like to see that flashback play out.
Yeah, that's my question yeah. is...
How did that work?
Yeah.
They just toss in the bag of fat to himself.
Yeah.
And stealing them. He's just trying
I guess
to jump over
why he
it.
Did... was underneath catching it, because he would have been tossing it to himself. Either that, or that's a like a manifestation of he was just like jumping down mm-hmm. with the bag and it caught and it just landed on him like, and it was inevitable, and yeah. in his head Tyler was throwing it to him. I don't know. Yeah, some of these scenes when you start to think about how did that play out alone is kind of weird.
My favorite one that does play out well to me is when Tyler and Marla are having sex and the narrator walks by the door, and the door opens, and Marla, like, falls off the bed. And Tyler's got, like, a rubber glove on, and he's like, you want to finish her off? And he just walks away, and she's like, who are you talking to?
Yeah. I like that one. The one that really intrigues me, and a lot of the movie hinges on this scene, too, is when they're fighting in the outside the bar, and then the other guys come up. And
that one does it is definitely a head scratcher.
Because why would those guys?
Why would
see
those
that
guys
like,
see
I
that?
I want in on that.
And they even yeah. do go back to that one and show like the guys just running up to him yeah. as he's punching himself.
But in
no
like in a way that they're like weirded out by it, not like mm-hmm. let's join this guy.
Yeah, there's.
Yeah, I was thinking about it on the way over. Like, how did that one? Like, how did it start? Like, they just saw this guy punching himself and was like, you look like you need something to punch. Punch me. Like, that doesn't... I don't think
I think that's one of those happens. Scenes that you're not supposed to think about when you hear the twist. And it was probably easier to hide in the book.
Yeah.
It's not a visual thing. I don't know. That's just my best guess.
Just makes me worried.
Unless he gave him some sort of off-screen Tyler speech about how it's probably. Such a great catharsis, good idea type shit.
In which case, they would all be just beating themselves up. Because that's apparently the only therapy they need. But they're crazy enough to do Fight Club, so maybe
so, yeah, I mean, like,
you know what, this
it's
guy
a small thing. It definitely is like, but whatever.
I mean, it could come... Well, I mean, it does come back when he beats himself up at the office with his boss, so mm-hmm. maybe he was just... Maybe he was actually doing that. Just giving himself practice.
I mean, yeah.
Beating the shit
out of
himself.
Well, yeah, that's the implication that he was just punching himself. But why do those people come up to him if he was
yeah,
just punching himself?
Yeah, I don't get it.
Yeah.
Strange.
It's very strange.
I love the scene in this movie when Tyler goes to rescue Marla from her hotel
yeah.
apartment. Brad Pitt is just so charismatic and great in that scene.
When they go in the hallway and he
yeah,
does the
when he just
dance.
Starts dancing.
Yeah. Because in any other movie, he would start making out with her or
yeah.
something like that. So that like,
but in like Ed Norton's character's head, like that's even the cooler
yeah.
thing to do. It's just like
this weird, like slow jazzy dance. Yeah, yeah, I love that. And the stuff that she's yelling about herself
yeah.
back at the cops and the firemen is kind of funny too.
You know, it's funny. I just watched Primal Fear for the first time mm-hmm. the other day. Have you seen it?
I've not.
It's Ed Norton's first film.
Really?
Which is just from 96, which is surprising that he just, like, blew up.
I didn't realize that.
Yeah.
Damn.
But he plays someone who's essentially crazy, and it's just weird that it's his typecast is.
Yeah. Apparently he's, and I don't want to alienate Ed Norton, apparently he's a little crazy. More of like he's a asshole.
No, yeah, I've heard that he's plays himself in Birdman.
Yeah.
So like,
which is, and it was such a feat to get him to agree to be in that movie, because he's apparently like tries to present this persona where he's not, but he's a huge, huge asshole.
Tragic.
Damn.
I don't know. A lot of them are. So.
Yeah.
I hope Brad Pitt's not.
As long as he hasn't diddled anybody, then you know what? Be an asshole.
Yeah, maybe yes. That's true. Maybe that's why he's an asshole.
No.
But from everything I hear, Brad Pitt is the nicest man ever.
I hope he is.
And his, cause he won the Golden Globe last night for supporting actor for Once Upon a Time in Hollywood.
Hell yes.
And like the end of his speech was so great. He made a reference to Leonardo DiCaprio. First of all, he calls him LDC, which is amazing. And the fact I've never heard that before in my life. But he makes a reference at the end that he would have made room for him on the raft. and then at the very end, he's about to walk off, and he has this, like, it's almost like he thought of it right then. Mm. Like, if you find an opportunity tomorrow to be kind to somebody, take it, because we could use a little bit of that right now. And then he walks off, and I'm like, aw, that guy's so nice.
Well,
he's adorable.
What a great guy.
What a great guy.
Yeah, more movies with him, please.
Great way to end a podcast talking about him beating the shit out of people.
Yeah. Much like the movie, excuse me, much like the movie has a bookend ending. I think in a different movie, this would have been like a more of a record scratch. This kind of has like a record scratch moment at the very beginning.
It does. But, like, hey, wonder how I got here, and then go back to the
plays ending. All the way through. another element of, and I've heard people say how, like, I've seen the You Met Me at a Very Strange Time in My Life appear on lists of like best movie quotes or best lines or something like that, like, again, to really cap off all the elements of that scene that send people out on such a high that I think if you were in any way conflicted about this movie in a bad way, that's what would be like.
I mean, I feel like it's just important to remember that the general audience is stupid. They're stupid people.
They don't
people who watch movies and don't think about them, don't think about them.
Well, yeah, we talked about how the first time we saw it, we were just watching it. It was like, oh, cool, fighting, whatever. Fincher's, you know, knows what he's doing. Camera going crazy.
Yeah, acting going good.
Yeah.
Like, yeah.
It was really the kind of thoughts I had when I was really high school. Yeah, exactly. So, yeah, imagine being an adult and having thoughts like that. It's pretty scary.
Yikes.
Not to alienate. If you're listening to this podcast, you're probably not that person, because you're thinking about movies so much that you're listening about other people talking them.
Other people are talking about analyzing movies.
Yeah. So good for you. You passed the test. You are not one of those terribly boring people. Hopefully not.
That I clapped when I saw The Thing audience members.
Yeah.
Oh, no.
Yeah.
Those people.
Yeah.
And hopefully you are not the kind of people that would need to join any type of violent organizations in order to find satisfaction in your life. Instead, you can watch movies about it. Well, I think that's all. That closes the book on Fight Club for me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a lot of what I had to say.
I don't know the next time I'll return this movie. I will say that. It was interesting to rewatch it. But I don't know when the next time.
We were talking about how I want to watch it again. Now
I was just saying that like Amanda should watch it.
I should watch it
again. Yeah, definitely.
To appreciate it. Yeah. But then after that, put it away for a while. I mean, I've seen this movie so many times that the only reason I watched it again was so we could talk about it and have it fresh in my memory.
I remember that. It's been a number of years since I watched it last. I think it was because I was watching all of Fincher's movies.
Mm-hmm.
So it was kind of... It's usually the completionist in me that watches movies like this, because there's a couple other movies from directors I really like that I'm like, eh, I never really need to see this again. But if I'm going through their filmography, I'm like, sure, I'll put it
on.
It's got a good Blu-ray. It's got his commentaries are really good, I will say.
Yeah.
David Fincher has great commentaries. You should give him a listen. The Blu-ray is kind of funny because when it goes through the opening logos and when it starts, it's a Blu-ray for Never Been Kissed. Like, it has like the opening, like... the intro to the menu for the Never Been Kissed Blu-ray with, what is that, Drew Barrymore? And then it's got all the play, things like that, and it sits on there for like 8 seconds, like, long enough for you to be confused and start pressing buttons, and then it like glitches out, and then the actual menu comes up, which the actual menu is that shot of all of his furniture just on loop.
Oh, that's
yeah,
that's cool.
Perfect.
And like all, like it's all the options are just kind of hovering there over it.
Do you own it?
Yeah.
You let me borrow that sometime, yeah, please. I will.
And it's got that really great, almost like elevator music playing over to that. Mm-hmm. It sounds like music from like a Wii menu, like the Wii Shop thing or something, yeah, like that. Like, it's really great. I love that. I love that shot in the film.
Hmm.
Well, that does it for me.
Yeah.
I'm plum tuckered out too.
Is there anything that you want to plug? Social media? Any projects you're working on? Or just a full hire me?
I mean, I'm gonna stay with the hire me. I'm not really working on anything right now. But if you'd like, and you don't already, you can follow me on Twitter. My handle is Wise. That's WYSE _ man, MAN. Wise _ man. And network with me so you can talk about hiring me.
Of course. Well, speaking of social media, you can follow us on Twitter and Instagram at Only Foreign Films. Mm. And I have another one. You can, if you'd like to, leave us a review on iTunes, or I don't know if Spotify does it, but you can definitely leave it on iTunes.
We've
leave us a nice little review.
I think two really great reviews on iTunes. I've read both of them.
But if you got to the end of this episode and you're like, I like these people, consider writing review. Yep.
It helps the algorithm and lets more people listen and hopefully leave more great reviews.
Yep. As always, you can get off.